The following program brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice. All economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal, and any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any persons for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax. Penalties that may be imposed on such persons and each listener should seek advice from their tax advisor or legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice, and nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show. Hey everyone, I'm back. Your Money with David Hayes. Thanks to Doug and Wayne for taking the reins last week. I heard they did a great job talking about budgeting and different ways to automate your financial life. So thank you very, very much. But today we're back to normal. A little news of the week, and then we'll get to Rod Holloway to give us a little market update. And then I was listening to a very, very popular radio show that happens to be right here on this station, also on financial advice. And I heard something that just about made me vomit a little in my mouth. So I'm going to come back and talk to you about how he had it all wrong. And I hadn't at this point had this next segment, the segment I'm talking about, compliance approved yet before I came on today. So I'm going to be a little bit careful in how I approach that just to be safe. All right. I know you can't wait. That's in two segments. Let's do a little news of the week brought to you by Monroe County Sports Hall of Fame. Of course, their banquet is coming up very soon. To learn more about Monroe County Sports Hall of Fame, go to mcshof.com. Hey, before I forget, thank you for the almost 200 vehicles that showed up at our wonderful shred day that we did on Wednesday of this week from 2 to 5. Car after car came rolling in, and we unloaded little bitty bags, and we unloaded truckloads. So it was a lot of fun. The weather held out, and we once again pulled it off. So thanks for those who came out. And if you missed it, you got to wait another year. It's kind of like Christmas time. All right, and here we go. News of the week. Three in a row, the S&P 500 has been down on a total return basis in February and March this year. It has only been down three or more consecutive months just three times in the last 10 years. This comes from By the Numbers. For tax year 2015, that's the latest year we have tax data that's been released from the IRS. It took $480,930 to be in the top 1% of all income earners, $195,000 plus to rank in the top 5, $138,000 to get in the top 10, and just under $80,000 a year to rank in the top 25% of all taxpayers. The top 5% of U.S. taxpayers paid more federal income tax during the tax year 2015 than all of the rest combined. That 141 million tax returns were filed back in 2015. Put it on a card. Well, this may have something to do with the millennials starting to make their way into the spending cycle. Credit card debt in the U.S. was $1.03 trillion as of February of 2018. That's the highest ever. The last time we were over a trillion like that was back in May of 2008, just before things went bad. That came from the Federal Reserve. The 10-year guess from the federal government, the U.S. government is projected to run a $12.4 trillion budget deficit over the next decade. We're bringing in $44.2 trillion of tax revenue versus the $56.6 trillion of spending outlays over the next 10 years. That forecast was released in April. Now, it comes from the Congressional Budget Office, so my question is, folks, do you think taxes are going to be higher in the future than they are today with running a deficit like that? Because back when this country started 221 years ago, we didn't borrow money. And then we started borrowing money when we needed to help fund things or kind of kick off some stimulus back in the, in the 40s or whatever. But it took a long time, till 2010, to actually acquire more than $12 trillion of debt in this country, and only 8 short years later, we're well over $20 trillion. Did you watch the Masters? Well, I did. I watched as much as I could, at least the Sunday. Patrick Reed is going to pocket, or did pocket, $1.98 million for winning the 2018 Masters. Did you know Arnold Palmer won $1.86 million during his entire 62-win PGA career. Wow, that comes from the PGA. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Hot Rod Holloway, who you hear on a regular basis on Glass in the Morning on Mondays and Fridays, giving you market updates. So we're going to steal him for just a few minutes to talk about where we are in the markets, what are we seeing. Of course, we're in the middle of earnings season already. Seems like we always talk about that. But what's it telling us? I mean, we're starting to see tax cuts make headlines with some of these large corporations. We'll be right back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Well, I'm glad to be back. You know, a week off does me some good. I was in Florida with my son's choir group, Sounds of South. They did a good job singing Friday night at Disney Springs. They performed for about 40 minutes and had a nice crowd. Sounded fantastic, but pretty much just messed around for the other 2.5 days. And they didn't get in any trouble, which was great. I was not an official chaperone. I was an unofficial chaperone, but that didn't really make any difference to my wife, which was a chaperone. I was the chaperone, so I had to behave myself and help keep the boys in line. But, you know, I'm not much for traveling around the parks at midnight. I'm kind of wanting to get back to the hotel. And one night, they left a park at 10 o'clock after dinner, and it was closing. And they said, "We're going to the Magic Kingdom." I'm like, "Oh, are you kidding me?" But I did it. That's what you do, right? Parents, you do it. All right, another parent on the line with me, Hot Rod. And Hot Rod, I know we're in the kickoff here of earnings season, and so far so good, but I don't think we expected anything different. What I am starting to hear is the mention of how tax cuts are making a big difference with some of their quarterly earnings and also obviously what they're saying going forward. So finally, we're starting to see the quarterly earnings come out. Tax cuts are in the news, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, most certainly. And, you know, and we knew that that was going to be a process for the companies to go through and evaluate, because obviously, you know, the bill came and got passed late enough that you had to wait for the IRS to come up with, you know, all of their information, for them to get it out, get it into the hands of the tax people, and then for them to start evaluating, okay, how does this impact us moving forward in the future? So you're starting to get that, and you're getting that on some of the quarterly conference calls as well, in which they're talking about the positive impact moving forward in the future on those tax cuts.
So quarterly earnings are starting to come out. Obviously, banks have been reporting. Anyone else been reporting anything of importance that we need to be keeping our eyes on?
Nothing too serious so far. They're coming in kind of as expected. We expected them to be strong. They're coming in. We're still early enough in there. We don't really kind of have the scorecard. Normally, once you start approaching about 50% of the earnings being released, then you start getting the scorecard as far as how many beats on the revenue and how many beats on earnings per share. But we haven't seen anything that has been overly alarming from a trend perspective. Obviously, there are going to be individual stories and individual situations that maybe aren't good like everything else. But for the most part, what we're seeing is what was expected. I think the only early sign that some people have been a little bit surprised with, and a lot of the big banks are kind of at the front end of the reporting for the quarter, is that they've been surprised that loan demand hasn't been a little bit stronger. The anticipation was that maybe with the tax cuts, a little more money in the retail person's pocket, a little more money in the small business owner's pocket, that maybe there would be a little bit more loan demand off of that. We've not seen that, but I also think you're in the early stages. Like for the consumer, you know, really most of the consumers didn't see it on their paycheck until their February paycheck. So I don't know that this first quarter not having robust loan growth is truly a sign for the rest of the year. But that's been the only thing that so far has come out in which the street has been a little bit disappointed with.
So I just reported in the news of the week that credit card debt in the U.S. was over $1.03 trillion in February, highest ever, and mentioned that, hey, you can tell the millennials are definitely starting to enter the spending cycle. And I think loan demand, what's interesting is when you look at their parents, the baby boomers, you know, they're not really interested in taking on more debt. They're interested in paying down debts or getting out of debt. I know friends that are in construction and different businesses that have a good cash flow right now, they're not interested in borrowing money. So to me, it's not a big surprise that there's not monster loan demand, but we'll see. I mean, I think to your point, when things rapidly expand, someone has to fund it, and that's where they'll head off to the bank. So we'll see. I'm not convinced that we'll see massive loan demand, but like I said, I mean, here's the other thing. Most people, understand that a bond, when you have a bond, it's a loan, but only about 6% of companies with over $20 million in sales are publicly traded companies. So you have 94% of companies out there are private. Well, they don't do bond issuance. They go to banks and borrow. So, you know, we'll see. I'm not convinced we're going to see heavy demand. Speaking of interest rates, I've been a little bit concerned that the Fed may get a little too quick on raising rates, and we're certainly seeing the front end of the curve kind of showing where it's settling in. The long end is still pretty low, flat as I've seen it probably in our entire career, Rod. I don't know. This is a little bit nerving to me. I know you and Eric have a lot of conversations in the back room about interest rates and yield curves and all of that. What's he saying that this yield curve is telling us?
So far, really, he hasn't been overly concerned about it. Obviously, the concern is that typically within roughly 12 months after an inversion of a curve, we have seen a recession. But when you go back and you look at most of those periods of time, in addition to an inversion, something else negative was going on that was kind of signaling some weakness in the economy. We don't see any of the signals from the weakness of the economy. And right now, the Fed's movements really are only impacting the short end of the curve, which is the increase in an interest rate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the Fed becomes concerned enough about it, they could begin to sell out of their balance sheet.
Right
now, their strategy is just to let it roll off. But if they would begin to flood the market with stuff that has some years left on it and not just let it roll off on its own, then they could begin to impact the long end of
right.
the curve to help alleviate that a little bit. Eric's biggest thing really has been a big reason for the long end not moving. It's demand. We still are considered one of the safe havens as far as putting your money in and feeling comfortable that you're going to get your principal back plus a small amount of interest, because you aren't getting a lot of interest off of that. So demand is a big thing that he believes is keeping the long end of the curve down low. So he doesn't necessarily see a fear from the flatness of the curve, but it's also something that we are having discussions about. We are looking at, because we're not going to ignore it and assume that, oh, this is completely different this time and it's not a signal of a potential recession. But there are no other indicators that would back up a flat yield curve to a potential inversion leading to a recession.
Yeah, one quick observation there. The Fed, still keep an eye on them. If they start unloading bonds in the long end, that could push yields up. But I think that it's going to force us to do what we should have been doing all along, issuing longer-term debt to finance this debt we have for a long time. We've been issuing shorter-term debt because the rates were lower and it made our current, you know, profit and loss statement, for lack of a better word, look better because we were paying less interest. But now with the short end practically the same as the long end, it might force us to start issuing that longer-term debt to finance these deficits. And, you know, as any business person would or a real estate person would, if I could lock in 30 years or 50 years or 100 years at 3 or 4%, would you do that? You'd do it all day long. But we haven't been doing that as the U.S. government. We've been buying where the cheapest interest rate was, so I think that might change things. One quick thing, Hot Rod, before I let you go. You know, we talk about how you should be as an investor, like what you should be investing in. And I know we've mentioned on the show before the book that Moshe Milevsky wrote called Are You a Stock or Are You a Bond? But I had a situation occur this past week where a tenured professor came in, and he's never read the book. He never listens to me on the radio. And he said, you know, shouldn't I be investing my money, you know, more aggressively or in stocks, because, you know, my job is really, really secure. My income is secure. I don't see this changing, and I'm, you know, fairly young. And I go, exactly. That's exactly the way you should look at this. You're the bond. You're spitting off this awesome income every single year, and then invest that in equities. But if you are a stock, you're a business owner, you're a roofer, you know, my friends are in their contracting business, they're in the furniture business, optometry, auctioneer, you know, whatever it might be, that could be cyclical. We know it's cyclical. You know, even you know, medical procedures or eyeglasses were down during the Great Recession because people weren't electively going in and having things done or buying that extra pair of Ray-Bans or whatever it might be. So, Rod, I think I wanted to kind of tell you that and then kind of get your comments about you looking at an individual and saying, yes, that person and how they earn their income should and could, and really should, I should say, dictate somewhat how you invest.
Oh, yeah, most certainly. It's much bigger than just the asset classes that everybody thinks about, stocks, bonds, and cash. It is. What's the job security of your job? What's the income? What's the possibility of your pay raises look like for the future? In retirement, what are your sources of income? Is it a pension? And it's a funded pension that you feel very comfortable with, then you can potentially take on a little more risk because your income may be covered off of a Social Security and pension, and therefore your retirement accounts are more for the wants, as we talk. We always talk in wants and needs in retirement, so maybe now your retirement dollars are more wants. Hey, I want to take a European vacation. It's not something you have to do, but you want to do it, so you can do that. So, yeah, most certainly, it is a big picture analysis when you look at what type of allocation makes sense for me. And it's not just the asset classes or just purely the time horizon and risk tolerance. It's also what's going on in your life. What's your job security look like? What's the income and potential for cost of living adjustments in that income for the future that should go into those decisions as well?
All right, Rod, we'll hear you on Glass in the Morning Friday, 7:20 sharp. You're like a broken clock. You're there every time whenever he demands it, and then again on Monday. So I won't see. I'm actually headed to Chicago after the show. I'll be bringing back some good information from First Trust and a little economic conference up there. So hopefully I'll bring some good stuff back to the office and back to the show next week. So, Rod, have a good weekend.
Thanks, Dave. You as well, and drive safe.
All right, thanks, man. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I was listening to a very popular radio show that gives a lot of advice on debt, cash flow management, and I wish that they wouldn't step into the investment world as deep as they have. So I was listening this past week to a couple situations, and I thought, I've got to bring this up because I love that show. I love the advice. I think it's helped so many people, but what they said and what they talked about when it came to investing and the investment products, again, it almost made me drive off the road. So I'll be back to talk about that and more. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. The only reason I'm not mentioning the show by name is because I hadn't received anything back from compliance that said it was okay for me to talk specifically about the show that I'm referring to. But y'all know who I'm talking about. So anyway, let me do this. I was listening last week about 10:30 in the morning to this wonderful station that I'm so happy to be on each and every week, and this person was talking to a 64-year-old woman who needs to start taking some income. Well, the suggestion was to invest in four categories of stock mutual funds, and they were very, very aggressive, and basically was told that, you know, they should average 8 to 12%, so you should just take that money out each and every year, and you're going to be just fine. And I just about drove off the road. I'm like, that's not at all how you set up a retirement income plan. Because the biggest risk when you do something like that is sequence of return risk. What happens when I take, you know, 3 or 4 or 5% out of the account and then the account goes down 10? That means I just took out 15 basically. And then you take out again and you're down again. If you go back and look at 2000, 2001, and 2002, which was by far worse than 2008 because we had multiple years that a person taking money out while the market's going down just completely compounded themselves to zero. Not the way to do it. Just about made me choke. Then they had a call in on someone who was trying to help their mom do some retirement income planning, and they were considering an annuity. And then they said on the show, the only annuity we ever recommend is a variable annuity. And then they went on to butcher what they actually do and what they are. He actually said they could guarantee 4 to 5% return and while being invested in mutual funds, and that's not how they work. Let me explain this. A variable annuity does this. You invest in mutual fund-like accounts. They charge something called a mortality and expense charge, and usually that runs about 1 to 1.1%, and that's just the wrapper the insurance company charges to package it up. Then on top of that, if you want to own an expanded or, you know, extra death benefit, which might lock in your value yearly or something like that, that's going to cost money. What if you want a guaranteed income benefit? That's going to cost money, probably another 1%. And when they talk about this 4 or 5% being a guaranteed return, that's not what that is. It's a guaranteed withdrawal rate. So what they're saying is if you'll pay us another 1%, we will guarantee that you can pull 5% at age 65 for life out of this. Now, if you do the math on this, that means that in 20 years, you've pulled all of your money out. So in 20 years, that's when the insurance company might be on the hook for something. And that's assuming you made no money at all in the contract. That's how they work. And basically, you're paying about 3 to 4% to own a variable annuity. Now, is that worth it? I don't know. I mean, maybe it is. I've talked about the cruise ship analogy many times on the show. Went on a cruise, right, in March for spring break. One cruise ship looks exactly like the other cruise ship. Goes to the same port, same entertainment, same food, same everything except one thing. The one on the left costs 20% more than the one on the right. What is the one difference? The one on the left has lifeboats. That's it. So a variable annuity has some lifeboats. Has some lifeboats for income. It has some lifeboats for death benefit. So I mentioned this in a program last week that I don't remember a cruise ship sinking since the Titanic. Now, there was the guy over in Spain that ran his boat up on a reef, I think, but it didn't sink. My point is the income insurance, death benefit insurance worth it to you? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I'm not going to bash things in general. I think that's always a bad idea. The other couple of annuities, you know, are fixed annuities where you have an interest rate that's fixed. You have a fixed maturity date. You can buy a 2-year, 3-year. It's like a CD to a bank, and you're going to get a little better interest rate generally. The third one is the fixed indexed annuity, and the fixed annuities have no cost. See, that's where when people say, oh, I don't want an annuity. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, I just don't like annuities. Well, why do you not like them? They're too expensive. Oh, really? Well, what about this fixed annuity? It has no cost. Well, I don't even know what you're talking about. This is a conversation I just had about a week ago with a brand new person that walked in my office. Well, let's talk about a fixed indexed annuity. A fixed indexed annuity, they come in all shapes and sizes, lengths and depths. And basically, the way it works is you can have 100% protection on the downside, 10% protection, 25%, you name it, all kinds of different variations. And it's usually linked to the market. It can be linked to the international markets. It can be linked to the S&P 500. Most of them are S&P 500. So the S&P goes up, you go up, maybe 50, 60%, just depends on the contract. If the market goes down, you don't lose anything. That's a zero loss version. Then there's others, like ones that will say, if the market's down less than 10% this year, you don't lose anything. I like that version. And on the upside, you're capped at something like 8.5%, 9%, 9.5%, depending on the index. Or maybe you buy a 6-year term, and you can make up to 80 or 90% on your money with a 10% buffer over 6 years. So, again, understand what these are, what their uses are, and be careful when you're listening to any radio show, including mine, to take what you hear as the absolute gospel, and that's what it is, and that's what it does. Because when I heard this explanation about variable annuities, I vomited just a little bit in my mouth, and I can tell you the truth about that one. All right, let me see. What else do I have here? Fixed income. I want to talk briefly before we take a break. I didn't get to it last time about fixed income bonds because I was going to have Eric on to talk about this but and had to hot rod, which is fine. But everyone's always freaked out about, okay, interest rates might go up. My bond values are going to go down. Yeah, but so what? Right now, rates haven't really moved that much on the long end. Short end's already kind of settled in. And if interest rates move 1% on the treasury rates and your values drop a little bit on your bonds, you don't want to be in long-term bonds is the bottom line. You want to stay in relatively short to intermediate, which that means somewhere between, you know, maybe 4 to 5 years up to maybe 12 years. That's short to intermediate in our world. But if interest rates move 1%, you will see your bond values decline, maybe 3, 4, 5%. But if you're earning interest on that bond of 3, 4, 5%, you'll backfill any of the unrealized loss on that individual bond during the year, and then you're back in the positive the following year. And as it rolls closer to maturity, that's what you're going to get. That's why we are, if you have enough money, big proponents of owning individual bonds, not bond funds. Bond funds are fine. But if you have enough assets and you can diversify yourself properly, owning individual bonds, in my opinion, is a better way to go. Because I know exactly what I'm going to get, when I'm going to get it. I know the credit of the bond I own. I know the maturity date. I know it. And I like that. I like to know things. All right, let's take a quick break. I've been talking so much about moving money from taxable accounts to tax-free but I don't think I've ever really done a good job of explaining how you do it. So we're going to take a little bit of time and explain actually moving money from taxable accounts to tax-free forever when we come back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. We play that bump music every week, folks, hoping that we'll see sunshine and pool days ahead and all of that. But, man, this morning, on Thursday morning, I literally leave the house and get in the car. I'm in the garage. I go to the office. And then I'm like, I need something in my car. So I run out, and it's spitting snow. On Wednesday, we had shred day. It was beautiful outside. But Thursday, it's spitting snow in the morning. I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm headed to Chicago tonight. I need a coat. So fortunately, my 9 o'clock appointment forgot to come in, so I was able to run home, get my coat, come back, and then settle in for my 10, 11, and 12 this afternoon. Ended up being fairly busy as well. But anyway, got me a coat, and I'm just thinking if we keep playing this music every single week, then eventually we'll have sunshine, warm weather, and pool days ahead. All right. Hey, I've been talking so much about taxes and getting out of the crosshairs of higher taxes down the road. This is a popular topic. Taxes in retirement, popular topic. We did a program over at Ivy Tech as kind of a pilot to see what the interest level was, how we can get people to come. And over the course of two meetings, I think like 100 people showed up. And out of that, 42 of them would like us to look at their tax situation and teach them how to move out of the crosshairs of higher taxes down the road. So I went through the whole thing. I went through the coming storm, just like I have here on the show. Talking about the historic opportunity that we have between now and the end of 2025, where we have lower tax rates. We know exactly what the cost of paying off that tax is today. I went through some of the unintended consequences of doing too much, too fast, and then just, you know, where taxes could go in the future and what the Congressional Budget Office is saying about this. So I set it up so that people understand, yeah, I need to do this, but then how do you do it? Well, how you do it is something that, you know, you need to know, right? So obviously, I think you should have a professional help you with this so that you don't get tripped up on some of the unintended consequences of doing things like a Roth conversion. Now, what is a Roth conversion? I have money sitting in my IRA, and I want to move it over to my Roth IRA. Well, you can do that, and when it happens, it's taxable. If you're under 59.5, all of it has to go in. So if I want to convert $5,000 from my traditional and I want to move it over to my Roth, then I can do that, and there's no penalty. It's just taxed. But what happens if I don't have the money to pay the tax? And I say, why don't you just withhold the tax from the conversion? You can do that, but the money that didn't get into the Roth and went to the IRS is considered an early distribution. That's a trip up. So let's say I say, no, I don't have any cash, but just pay it out of the IRA. Fine. I move $5,000 out. I send $1,000 to the IRS, let's say, and I'm 45 years old. That $1,000 is not only taxed, I know you paid the tax on the $5,000, not only is it taxed, but there's a 10% penalty on that $1,000. So when you do a Roth conversion, make sure, and you're under 59.5, make sure you have the cash to pay the tax. Now, if you're over 59.5, not as big of a deal. You can transfer it. You can have the tax withheld. You still pay taxes on the taxes, on the money that came out, but you don't pay a penalty. So that's a little advice. What about in-plan conversions? Most plans that offer a Roth arm to their 403B or 401K allow for in-plan Roth conversions. Again, everyone has to have the cash outside to pay the tax on that transfer because you cannot withhold tax on an in-plan conversion. So regardless of your age, you have to have the cash. So don't willy-nilly go in and say, oh, I have enough room in my tax bracket to convert $35,000. And you do that, and then all of a sudden you owe 22% or 12% or whatever bracket that you're in, and you don't have the money because then you're on the hook with the IRS and run into all kinds of different penalties. So it's really important to understand how you do it and some of the little pitfalls and trip-ups that you have, and understand that things like Social Security, if you're at that age, taxed differently, then capital gains are taxed differently. It all kind of coordinates together. So sometimes, and I had this happen with a person actually within today, who said, man, I took out $50,000 last year from my retirement account, didn't withhold anything because I didn't know what to withhold. He was doing it on his own.
prior to that. And he said it cost me, what are you telling me? It cost me $24,000 of tax, almost half. Now, he only had a small pension and some Social Security. Well, what happened prior to taking it out, none of his Social Security was taxed. So he had $29,000 of Social Security that hadn't been taxed. Well, as soon as he pulled the 50 out, it bumped him well over the limit. 85% of his Social Security now became taxed. So like 27,000 of his 29 or whatever it was became taxed, plus the 50. So instead of paying taxes on just 50, he was paying it on the whole 77,000. And that's how he paid nearly 50% tax on his distribution from his IRA. Now, the idea here is that if you have enough time, transfer the smart amount of money over each and every year from your traditional sources to your tax-free sources, so that, for instance, when you get to age 70 and a half and you have to start taking the money out, that you have a lower pot that you're being forced to take it from. I told someone this the other day in the meeting that right now, when you get to age 70 and a half, the table that we all use assumes that you have a spouse 10 years younger. Everyone uses the same table. It also says that at 70 and a half, you divide your account balance by 27.4. So if I'm 70 years old, does the IRS really think I'm going to live to 97? No. But because they assume you have a spouse 10 years younger, they like to stretch it out a little bit further. But if they would simply move to the single life table, now you have to divide it by like 17. Well, that accelerates the distributions from the retirement account, even without raising taxes, creates more tax revenue. And just like Social Security, I'm sure the IRS with a switch of a pen could change the rule to say, we're no longer using the unified table, we're using the single table. And just like that, you're being forced to take out about a third more income than what you had planned to take out. So as much as you can possibly move from taxable to tax-free, I think that's what you should do. What if you're, making contributions to a 401k? Put it in the Roth. I don't care how much money you make. Put it in the Roth. You know what the cost is today. It's 12, 22, whatever, 20, 24, whatever that is. I'm losing track. Or 37, whatever it is, you know what the cost is. And especially if you're younger, and you're young and you have kids at home, whatever, and your money's going into the traditional side, don't do it. Put it into the Roth side. The money the company puts in for you, that goes into the traditional side. So they're building a pile of taxable forever money anyway, so do yourself a favor. You'll be glad you did. Move as much as you can to the tax-free side. The other thing, don't forget about the backdoor Roth IRAs. If you make too much money to put money into a Roth, anyone can do a conversion. So keep that in mind. I don't care how old you are, how much money you make, anybody can do a conversion, which is kind of funny because it's like, wait a second, you make too much money to put in $6,000, but you can make whatever and convert up $1 million. It doesn't make any difference. So the backdoor Roth, if you make too much, you can make a non-deductible IRA contribution, then immediately convert it to a Roth. But be a word of caution. If you have other IRAs, they're included in that calculation, so it would not all be tax-free on the conversion. So again, backdoor Roth, a little bit of warning that if you have other IRAs, you're probably not going to be able to easily do a backdoor Roth IRA. Is that a lot to think about in a short amount of time? I think so. Remember, I committed to slowing down, speaking more clearly, and not acting like a goofball. So I think that last segment, I didn't do a very good job. So let's take a break. When we come back, I do want to talk, because some of the stuff's coming up in these programs that we're doing, I want to talk about Social Security. Still a lot of questions about what's still available as far as these different strategies go, some recent examples that I've been through with people. I want to go through some of that because it's important and it means a lot to a lot of people that are listening to the show. So we'll take a quick break, come back, talk about that and more. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Most people in America who don't listen to the show, do not have a financial advisor, take Social Security as soon as they possibly can. So they retire at 62, not making any more money. They take it because they think, well, I might as well get it while I can. Well, I can understand that, but I can assure you that they're going to do something about Social Security to fix it, because even future beneficiaries, even if nothing changes, are going to get about 77 cents of every dollar promised. I mean, even when the fund goes belly up. I think they'll make some changes sooner than later, hopefully here in the next few years, so we can get this thing put to rest. But it is one of the biggest entitlement programs out there, so people are always looking at the break-even points. Well, we did some math, and this came actually from Transamerica. They provided it to us. About taking it at age 62, what's your break-over point? Well, if your full retirement age was 66 and you took it at 62, the break-over age was 78. So if you live longer than 78, then you're better off to have waited until you're 66. Now, what about waiting until you're 70? So let's say you took it at age 62, and the difference between waiting to age 70, the breakover was, let's see, I have it right here. It was 80 and a half years, so 80.5. So if you live past 80, then you would have been better off waiting until age 70. So those are kind of the math behind the break-even analysis. But where I think we get tripped up is, remember that if one of you wait until 70, and the reason you wait till 70, you get an 8% annual increase, and at age 70, you know, you get 30-some percent more than you would have at 66. So anyway, but it becomes the family benefit. So let's say that benefit's $3,300 at age 70, and you die. Well, that $3,300 continues on to your surviving spouse if you're married. Well, there's a statistical chance that, a good one, that one of you is going to live well into your 90s. So for me, if you can afford it to get through the gap, it generally is better to have some kind of a strategy to delay. But the real question is, what are the strategies that are still available? Yeah, the delay strategy, delaying it till 70, that one's simple. I just don't take it, I delay it. But who's still eligible to take some of these elaborate claiming strategies? Well, they did away with pretty much everything. Unless you're divorced or you're a widow, you still get to do the old file and suspend and restrict and all that. But they still do allow, for some people, a restricted application. Now, that means you had to have been at least 64 in January, okay? So this isn't for everyone. It's a very short window. Age 64 in January, you'd still be eligible to do a restricted application. Now, you have to be full retirement age to do it. So here's the situation that came up just this past week. Mom was on Social Security. She'd been on it for quite some time. Dad just turned 67, or was getting ready to turn 67. And I'm like, why have you not filed a restricted application? Well, they didn't know what that was, and no one's going to call you from Social Security. What's that mean? Well, you can file a restricted application and receive 50% of what your wife's benefit would have been had she waited until full retirement age to take it. Well, that ended up being about $1,200. And then you delay yours until 70. Which by delaying his, and he's still working, he was going to delay his to 70, and then at 70, his benefit would be right around $3,300 a month by delaying it. But that was $1,200 a month, you know, for the next 3 years. And we actually were able to backdate the application all the way until October. So he got a big fat check, you know, for basically 6 months of that, and he'll continue to get $1,200 a month. Free money, and if you didn't file for it, you're not going to get it. So that's still available, a restricted application. If you'd like to know more about how to do that, shoot us an email over at cfci.us. We have some really cool Social Security claiming software, and by just plugging in a few things, it'll tell you exactly what and when you need to do it. We'll do it for you for nothing. I mean, it takes us 5 minutes. Put Kevin to work on that, too. I could keep mentioning this Kevin guy. He sits in my office and plugs on the computer all day long, and I know he listens to the show as well. So I think he's doing something over there, but we'll see. So why don't you put him to work? Shoot us an email, cfci.us. Kevin can run a Social Security analysis for you. He can do a tax map for you as well. We're running an ad right now about that. So both, complimentary. You can call him, sit down with him, whatever you need to do, and he can show you exactly how much availability there is for you to do a Roth conversion at your current tax rate. He can do a Social Security claiming strategy for you. And then if you need more than that, then he'll hook you up with one of the advisors in the office. So that's it on Social Security. Again, if you're divorced, married 10 years, divorced, not remarried before Social Security age, then you can also still do some old file and suspend and restricted applications. Or if you're a widow, married 2 years and a widow, then you're also eligible. That was something that came up recently. Age 60 years old, she could take widow's benefits and delay her own benefit until age 70. So a lot of really cool and useful applications when it comes to Social Security. So don't think it's as simple as that sounds, and all the things that we used to be able to do are gone, because for a select group of people, they're still available. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back to wrap up the big show. This is YOMO with David Hayes. So if you think I sound like a broken record, will you please let me know that as well? I'm trying to improve the show the best I can. I've only been doing it for 16 years, so give me a break. It should be better than this, right? But we're trying to give you useful information, stuff you can actually act on, some on your own, some you're going to need some professional help. Obviously, the complexity of things is a little irritating to most, but for me, I like it because it gives me a job. And for that reason, I enjoy things being very complex. Hey, I thought I'd share this funny story with you. Fees in our world, have been under scrutiny. I mean, it's hard to justify paying a fee for someone to manage your money. And that's why we're trying to show people, hey, for paying this fee, you should be getting this wonderful tax planning. You should be getting estate planning, all the things, to help keep you out of the crosshairs of higher taxes down the road, make sure money passes to your beneficiaries the most tax-efficient way. So there's value to that, right? Well, I had a friend of mine who's an attorney, and he now is a practicing financial advisor in Philadelphia. His name's Stu. And Stu was a personal injury lawyer. And we were having a powwow at one of our meetings about, how to justify the fee, what you should be doing for the fee. And he said, all I tell my clients is, listen, you think 1% is bad? You should have known me when I was an attorney. I got 30%. I said, that's perfect. But you know what? I wasn't an attorney that charged 30%, Stu, so I'm going to have to go back to the basics and justify the fee that we're charging folks to manage their money and manage their retirement income plans and all the different tax strategies that we talk about. So, yeah, if you ever think about, boy, it's expensive to have a financial advisor, it's not that expensive. Go hire an injury attorney. That's 30%. But you know what? You can't do that on your own either, for the most part. All right, we got a good one next week. I've got a lot of good things coming on. I'm getting confused on my dates because I've been so busy following up with all these people from the tax workshops. I can't hardly see straight. And I'm headed to Chicago after tonight's show, so I'll be out of the office on Friday. Be back in the office on Saturday to kind of work through a bunch of things and then try to fit in some turkey hunting on Sunday morning before church. And then my wife's off for a girls' trip to Tampa, so my boy and I are going to be batching it for 3 or 4 days, and then, I don't know, I have an Ed Slot meeting coming up soon, and then I have a conference over in San Francisco, so busy, 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 but thankfully tax season is behind us, because that was a nightmare, but we got through it. Thankfully, the folks in my office are they answer the phone with a smile, even though it's the very last minute on tax day, and someone calls and says, can you just print off all my tax documents? I clearly can't find them. So so there's a sign in our office that's something about, your urgency is not my emergency. But you know what? When you're serving other people, their urgency, unfortunately, is your emergency. So listen, folks, I hope you enjoyed the show. Again, if you need any help at all when it comes to trying to figure out how much you can convert from taxable to tax-free, we're happy to do a free tax map for you. And on top of that, if you'd like a free Social Security analyzer, we can do that. Just shoot us an email at cfci.us, and we'll put old Kevin to work. He's sitting right in my office. We're out of space in my office. We're running, I guess that's when you grow. What kind of problems you have? All right, guys, we're going to let you go. Have a great weekend, everyone. Goodbye.
The preceding program was brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.